Have you ever had one of those moments where you made what seemed like a relatively insignificant decision, but as you look back on it, it changed your life? You can go online and you can find all of these little insignificant decisions that impacted history. In 1912, Theodore Roosevelt was president of the United States, and he was giving a speech and had a 50-page manuscript. I was thinking about that this morning. My manuscript for today is 7. So you can imagine what a 50-page manuscript speech would be like. Anyway, he folded it in half, stuck it in his breast pocket, went to get on the platform when an anarchist shot him at point-blank range and struck the speech. Teddy Roosevelt went ahead and gave the speech anyway. Or in 1914, the Archduke Ferdinand was an assassination attempt. An individual tried to blow him up, was unsuccessful, and killed or injured his driver. His driver was in the hospital, so the Archduke decided he would go visit him. As he was going to the hospital, he got lost, took a wrong turn down a road that took him right back to the assassin, who finished the job and began World War I. We could go to 1968, and John F. Kennedy was headed to Dallas and said to those who wanted to put the top on the top of the motorcade, no, I would like to have the top off today. That little decision ended up costing him his life. Or in 1968, not all of them are bad decisions. Martin Luther King, as he stood on the Lincoln Memorial, preparing to give maybe his most important speech, looked at the prepared text and decided they were not inspirational enough. And he changed his speech and went with, "I have a dream." We're at one of those moments this morning where I am convinced that had you been in the first century, had you been there when the crowd said it, no one would have even begun to imagine the events that were sealed. And in John chapter 12, in verse 34, the crowd speaking up to Jesus said, "We've heard from the law that the Christ will remain forever. So how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man you're talking about?" And their rejection is sealed. We're going through the Gospel of John, and really the last 14 verses of the 12th chapter, I'm convinced, are really a summary of everything that has transpired up to this point. We don't know for certain how long Jesus ministered. If you just have Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you would conclude that Jesus' ministry was a year long. But John actually shares 4 separate Passovers. And for the first 12 chapters, we've been making our way through this journey, and we've watched as Jesus has traveled for at least 3 years, doing an amazing amount of work. And at the midpoint of the gospel, we are now just days, just hours away from his crucifixion. A couple weeks ago, I threw this timeline up here of the Holy Week. And as you try and figure out the events that happen on certain days, there's a lot of disagreement, a lot of argument amongst theologians as to exactly what transpired. Some of the things, we know that Palm Sunday was on a Sunday. We know that the resurrection was on a Sunday. Most would say the crucifixion took place on Friday. And so most of chapter 12 takes place on that Sunday. But I'm convinced that John chapter 12, beginning in verse 36, jumps us forward to probably Tuesday or Wednesday night. I think there is a gap because Jesus is going to tell us that after this takes place, he will never again speak in public. In fact, the text goes something like this. In verse 35, Jesus told them, "You are going to have the light just a little while longer. Walk while you have the light before the darkness overtakes you. The man who walks in the dark does not know where he is going. Put your trust in the light while you have it, so that you may become sons of light." And when he had finished speaking, Jesus left and hid himself from them. The next time the crowds will see Jesus, he will be on the steps of Pilate's hall, and they will be screaming, "Crucify him." His public ministry is over. I'd like to just have the last half or the last 14 verses of John 12 read for you this morning.
Even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet. "Lord, who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" this reason they could not believe. Because, as Isaiah says elsewhere, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, so they can neither see with their eyes nor understand with their hearts, nor turn, and I would heal them. Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory and spoke about him. Yet at the same time, many, even among the leaders, believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they would not openly acknowledge their faith for fear they would be put out of the synagogue. For they loved human praise more than praise from God. Then Jesus cried out, "Whoever believes in me does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. The one who looks at me is seeing the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. If anyone hears my words but does not keep them, I do not judge that person. For I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. There is a judge for the one who rejects me and does not accept my words. The very words I have spoken will condemn them at the last day. For I did not speak on my own, but the Father who sent me commanded me to say all that I have spoken. I know that his command leads to eternal life. So whatever I say is just what the Father has told me to say."
This morning, I think you can summarize Jesus' ministry this way. I think John summarizes it this way, that some would not believe, some wanted to believe, but all of us need to believe. He begins with one of the saddest verses in all the Bible. It says, even after Jesus had done all these miraculous signs. One of the struggles we have living 2,000 years after it, we live in a very scientific age in which we have a really hard time believing in the miraculous. And many will come to the life of Jesus and say, he was a great man, he was an incredible speaker, he was an inspirational figure, but come on, miracles don't really happen. But that's not the first century take. In fact, there's no disagreement. John chooses, he tells us in chapter 21, that I could go and fill all of the books in all the world with all of the miracles of Jesus, but I have just chosen these seven. And the seven he does choose are incredibly public miracles. Many of the other gospel writers will share miracles that are done in private, of the Syrophoenician woman whose son is demon-possessed and Jesus casts out the demon, or Peter, James, and John on their boats cast the net on the other side. But the miracles that John chooses are chosen because they're very public miracles. Miracles that many saw and couldn't be argued with. We begin back in chapter 2 with Jesus turning the water into wine. And at a wedding, there are many people around. He then goes to chapter 2 at the end where he goes into the temple and cleanses the temple. And he foreshadows his greatest miracle by saying, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will rebuild it. In chapter 3, there are many sons who are healed, but he chooses an official's son, a man of great respect, of great importance. People would look up to this man and listen to what he said. That is the miracle he chose. And then in chapter 4, he goes to the pool of Bethesda, and probably hundreds of people are around the pool hoping for a chance to get into it to experience a miracle themselves. Jesus chooses a man who's been lame for 38 years. He doesn't have a broken leg. He hasn't got a messed up hip. He's somebody who hasn't walked in 38 years, and Jesus simply says, take up your mat and walk, and he does. And then a big argument breaks out between Jesus and the Pharisees, and the argument isn't over, did you really perform a miracle? No, the argument is over, Jesus, you're a miracle worker. We'll give you that. But you know you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, and because you're a miracle worker, your work is miracles, and by doing a miracle on the Sabbath, you violated the Sabbath. The whole discussion is whether or not Jesus has the right to perform miracles on the Sabbath, not did he perform a miracle. In chapter 6, he has maybe his largest audience of any of his miracles. He literally brings down food from heaven and feeds the multitude. And then They recognized the miracle. In fact, in chapter 6, after the people saw this miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who has come into the world. And Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew. Imagine if your king, your president, could provide all of your material possessions from nothing. That would be a pretty good king. They wanted somebody who would feed them, who would clothe them, who would house them. They knew the miracles that he was doing were real. Chapter 9, the sixth miracle is Jesus healing the blind man. And once again, John takes the time to share the discussion. And the discussion isn't over whether or not this man was blind. The parents say, yes, he was our son. He was born blind. The discussion is over by what power does Jesus do his miracles. And then the greatest miracle, the one in chapter 11, is Lazarus being raised from the dead, having been dead for 4 days. See, I think verse 47 and 48 sum up well where the Pharisees, where the people who rejected Jesus were. The chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, and he says, we're accomplishing nothing. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. They saw the miracles. They knew they were miracles. But they also recognized if we accept him on his terms, we might very well lose our place and our nation. We will have to give up control of our lives. And we're just not willing to do that. And so John concludes that many, many were unwilling. But in case all of the miraculous signs Jesus had performed weren't enough, how about if you could hear God the Father speak? You have that chance in chapter 12. John summarizes it this way. Then a voice from heaven came. I have glorified it and I will glorify it. And the crowd that was there heard it. And some said, well, it's just thunder. Others said, no, an angel spoke. And Jesus said, this voice was for your benefit, not mine. Now is the time of judgment on this earth. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. But I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. He said this to show what kind of death he was going to die. And the people listening jump on it. Now, one of the struggles we have when we come to the Gospels is, in order to really understand it well, we have to have a very firm understanding of the Old Testament. And I fear that many of us don't know the Old Testament as well as we should. He talks about the Son of Man. That's Jesus' favorite term for himself. But do you know where the term comes from? The term comes from the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel is one of my favorite books in the Old Testament, maybe because it's my name. I don't know. But the first six chapters, Daniel lives this amazing life. And then beginning in chapter 7, we begin to experience his many visions, the chance to see the future. The very first vision in chapter 7 are these series of beasts which represent the four kingdoms that will finish out the earth. And then finally we get a chance to be introduced to the Ancient of Days. And in verse 13 you read, in my vision, Daniel says, at night I looked and there before me was one like the Son of Man. And he was coming in the clouds of heaven, and he approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. And he was given authority and glory and sovereign power. And all nations and peoples of every language worshiped him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Jesus, if you're really the Son of Man, you can't die because the Son of Man doesn't die, right? Well, John, as he begins to summarize the teaching of Jesus, says, okay, you want to go back to the Old Testament. Let's go back to the Old Testament. And he says, this was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet. Lord, who has believed our message and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Most of us have the incredible privilege of having a footnote that you can click on and it will tell you where it's from. I'll save you the effort of looking it up. It's from Isaiah 53. It's verse number 1 of Isaiah 53. I don't think it was John's intention simply to take us back to verse 1. I think he was conjuring up all of Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53, beginning in verse 2, reads this way. For he, speaking of Messiah, grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by man, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteem him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken from the transgression of my people, and they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Isaiah 53, we could spend the rest of the morning looking at, is an incredible passage, but I don't know if you picked up on it or not, but it's all past tense. Written 700 years before Messiah arrives, what would happen to Messiah was already predicted and settled. Jesus, Messiah, would become a sin offering. I guess I don't know for certain, but I'm guessing that none of us here have ever watched an animal sacrifice. The Jews, some every day, went to the temple. And an animal sacrifice is a horrific event in which the animal is killed, its blood is spilt for the sin of that person. Messiah would be a sin offering meant only one possible outcome. Messiah would die for our sin. John says, it's true. The kingdom of Messiah will last forever. But first, Messiah would die. And then John makes an interesting and terrifying comment. One of the big struggles you have when you come to theology is, where does the sovereignty of God and the free will of man, how do you put those together? And some will argue so strongly for the sovereignty of God that they deny humans have a free will. Some will argue so strongly for the free will of man that they deny the sovereignty. I strongly would suggest the Bible teaches that God is absolutely sovereign and is never thwarted by the will of men. But we do have a choice. But there's an interesting play of words. In verse 37, it says they would not believe. In verse 39, it says they could not believe. He goes back to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah chapter 6 is the passage in which Isaiah in chapter 1 is chosen by God to be his prophet. He begins prophesying. In chapter 5, he declares all of the woes of the society around him. And then in chapter 6, he's given the incredible privilege that only a few people in the history of humanity have ever had, to be ushered into the very throne room of God and to see God seated on his throne, to see the angels flying around, covering their heads and covering their feet and declaring, "Holy, holy, holy." And Isaiah changes from "woe is you" to "woe is me." The angel comes and he touches Isaiah's lips with a coal, cleansing him. And then he hears the cry out, "Who shall I send? Who will go for me?" And Isaiah says, "Here am I, send me." And this is his commissioning. God says to Isaiah that I have blinded their eyes, I have deadened their hearts, so they can neither see with their eyes, nor understand with their hearts, nor turn. And I would heal them. The point is, there comes a moment when you have rejected God one time too many, and God says, "I'm done with you." You have moved from the would not to the could not. Lest you think it's just the Jewish nation, Paul in Romans chapter 1 says the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the ungodliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they chose neither to glorify him as God nor give thanks to him. And then their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. I don't know when it happens, and I don't think God always explains it to us, but there comes a moment when would not becomes could not. And the choice may not seem all that significant at the moment. Many of the Jews would eventually turn to Christ. But as a nation, their fate was sealed. I don't know if you've watched the movie Titanic or not, but it's an interesting movie for a number of reasons. It's this whole idea of the arrogance of man, of the grandeur of man, and the power of the sea. But there's, for me, a fascinating moment when the fate of the entire crew is sealed.
"Most unfortunate, Captain."
"Water, 14 feet above the keel in 10 minutes. In the 4P, in all three holds, and in boiler room 6.
"That's right, sir."
"When can we get underway?"
"That's 5 compartments. She can stay afloat with the first 4 compartments breached, but not 5. Not 5. As she goes down by the head, the water will spill over the tops of the bulkheads at E deck from 1 to the next, back and back. There's no stopping it."
"The pumps, if we open the
doors..." "The pumps buy you time, but minutes only. From this moment, no matter what we do, Titanic will founder."
"But this ship can't sink."
"She's made of iron, sir. I assure you, she can. And she will. It is a mathematical certainty."
"How much time?"
"An hour, 2 at most."
"And how many aboard, Mr. Murdoch?"
2,200 souls on board, sir.
I don't know all of the truth of Titanic. In fact, I'm not sure anybody really does. But there are stories of, after Titanic had struck the iceberg, people were grabbing snow off the iceberg and having snowball fights, because they were convinced everything was fine. But their fate was sealed. Israel would continue as a nation for 40 years after John chapter 12. They would see Jesus die, rise from the dead, the church begun, and actually the church began to spread, and most of the New Testament written. But in 70 AD, the Romans came and destroyed the nation. All were murdered or enslaved or chased around the globe. And the nation ceased to be a nation for the next 2,000 years. Because at this moment, God said the would not is now could not. I'm not trying to scare us, but I do believe there is a sober moment for all of us. The only moment we have is this one. Because I don't know what comes next. Before the service, Andy was practicing, and I had shared that we were going to sing three songs, and then would he come up and lead the last song, and I said the message would be in between of them, and he says, well, I'm not going to do that unless something happens to you. And then he said he could come up with something quick. Well, I hope nothing's going to happen in the next few moments. But the interim pastor before I came was a man by the name of Adolf Braun. After leaving Victor, he went back to the church that he had pastored for years and served as an interim there. And on one Sunday morning, he preached a sermon, started to leave the stage, fell, and died from a heart attack. I don't know. Maybe I won't leave the stage this morning. Maybe you won't leave the church. Maybe you won't make it home. Now is the only day of salvation. And I implore all of us to make certain that while we can believe, that we do believe. Amen. But John continues, and verse 42 and verse 43, I will admit, are some really tough verses, because he says, yet at the same time, many, even among their leaders, believed in him. I wish he stopped there, because it would be a much clearer point. But there's this word, but. Sometimes it's good news in the gospel. God decided to destroy the world by flood, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Here, many believed, but because of the Pharisees, they would not confess their faith for fear they would be put out of the synagogue, for they love praise from men more than praise from God. I don't know if the leaders that John is talking about were true followers of Jesus. I do know that Jesus is very clear in Matthew chapter 10 that anyone who acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge before my Father who's in heaven. But anyone who denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father who's in heaven. I think, I'm not sure. But I think what John is saying is that there were some who really wanted to believe, but were too afraid of what others might do, might say. And let's be honest, we all have experienced that. If you have been walking with Christ for some time, my guess is every single one of us in this room, and I include myself in that, have had that chance when I've had a chance to speak up, and as about I'm ready to speak up, I think, oh no, what are they going to think if I say that? Do I allow fear to keep me from doing the will of God? But John ends, and I'm convinced, verse 44, the Lumo video has this as part of this last Passion Week. I think what John is doing is he's picking a passage of one of Jesus' sermons from sometime during his ministry and sharing, this is the best summary of what I can think of in a short period of what Jesus' life and ministry was all about. And we could spend the rest of the morning, we could spend the rest of the month, we could spend maybe the rest of our lives, and it would be worthwhile. But let me just see if I can't quickly summarize Jesus' teaching. He begins by saying, Jesus came to show us the Father. Then Jesus cried out, when a man believes in me, he does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. At the core of the gospel is an understanding of the triune nature of the Godhead. We don't have time to go back to, but one of the most intriguing verses in the entire passage, and I think I've now said that about every verse in the passage, but this one really kind of blows my mind, is at the end of Isaiah chapter 6, John says, Isaiah saw who sitting on the throne? not the Father. He saw Jesus on the throne. See, the triune nature of God is such that Jesus came so that if you want to see God, look at Jesus. If you want to know what God is like, look at Jesus. If you want to know God, know Jesus. That Jesus didn't come simply to share himself. He came because he is the incarnate God, this triune God who exists eternally in these three persons. That is at the very core of his teaching. We don't understand it. I get that. I can't explain it, I assure you. And yet I believe that Jesus came not simply to display himself, but to display the Father as well. But he says, I've also come into the world as a light so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. We who live in the 21st century really struggle with this verse because we don't understand darkness. My guess is most of you have at some point in your life had a job or a situation where you had to work at night. But it wasn't really that big a deal. You just flipped a switch and suddenly the room is illuminated as if it's daytime. There's almost no place you can go where there is true darkness. My mother-in-law shared several years ago a story of her growing up that when she grew up, they didn't have electricity in the house. And so as a little girl, particularly in winter, when the sun would set at 4:30, 5 o'clock, there was a single lamp in their entire house that sat at the table. If you wanted to do anything, you sat around the table to read, to do your homework, to do your needlework, to do whatever. But she shared that the light was really not adequate to do most of it. And after a while, your eyes would get tired and you'd wander off and go to bed at 6 or 7 at night because there was nothing else you could do. Darkness made every task you wanted to do nigh unto impossible. In the first century Palestine, they're close enough to the equator that the days are very close to 12 hours, irregardless of the season. And so that meant almost every day of your life, the sun set close to the 6 o'clock hour, and you were plunged into darkness. You didn't dare travel. It wasn't safe to travel. You couldn't really do work unless there was a bright moon. But this consuming darkness was part of life in the first century. And Jesus takes that as an illustration from the physical realm into the spiritual realm. We are living in darkness. The problem is a blind man doesn't care if the light is on because he can't see anyway. We are blinded by our sin nature, but Jesus came to illuminate our lives so that we can truly see life as it really is. In Jesus. But sadly, Jesus warned of judgment. As for the person who hears my words, but does not keep them, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save it. There is a judge for the one who rejects me and does not accept my words. That very word which I have spoken will condemn him at the last day. We don't like to talk about judgment very much. I don't like to talk about judgment very much. Jesus did. And awaiting those who reject him is judgment. But don't forget the other side of it. That while he spoke of judgment, he came to bring eternal life. As we come to the close of that first section of the Gospel of John, the book of signs, John wants us to be reminded that Jesus did some amazing things, but it is irrelevant to us unless we believe. The question of the morning is, do you? Father, I thank you for Jesus' story. I thank you for the amazing miracles that he has done. But I pray this morning, as each of us contemplate our relationship to you, that it might not be about religious activity. It might not be about what we do or rituals we participate in. But God, I pray that every single one of us can say we have moved from the will not to the will believe. And this morning, we enjoy eternal life and the prospects of eternity in your presence, not because we've earned it, but because we have simply, through your amazing grace, received life through faith. God, I pray that there would be no one leave this morning still struggling with whether or not they would believe. I pray that all of us will believe. For it's in your Son's holy and precious name we pray.